This is Michael Reinhart, welcoming you to the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. We are led by our two hosts, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. This podcast is sponsored by the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. The association offers a 50% discount on membership to our podcast listeners when they go to www.adcg.org and use code POD. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and please feel free to leave us a rating or comment.
This is Jody Westby, and I'm here today with my co-host, Jerry Buckley. Today, we are honored to have with us one of the cybersecurity professionals who's most informed about the U.S. Department of Defense Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification Program, lovingly known as CMMC. Carter is Vice President, Cybersecurity, and Chief Cybersecurity Officer for Soundway Consulting. Carter's a CISSP and has actively contributed to the GSA-DoD final report to the White House entitled Improving Cybersecurity and Resiliency Through Acquisition. His work products have been actively used by DoD, Department of Education, DHS, the ISAC communities, Smart Cities, and the Georgia Bar Association for continuing learning educational CLE credits on the topic of cybersecurity risk and liability. Carter also recently co-authored Guidance for Smart Cities and Municipalities Supply Chain Risk Management, published by NIST. So he has been around the block. He's one of the most respected people in the field and has helped with our public sector side cybersecurity in numerous ways. He's also served on the CMMC accreditation body. Wow, Carter, you have such a rich history in the evolution of CMMC, and I sort of feel like I have to ask you if you've been on a roller coaster. CMMC has been up and down and around so many curves. Now DoD has just released CMMC 2.0. So let's start there. What does CMMC 2.0 really mean for the government contracting community? Is this a big change from 1.0? And can you provide us with your take on all of that?
Yeah, certainly. Well, first off, thank you, Jody, for being able to have me on your show today. Do one point of clarification. So I've never been on the accreditation body for CMMC. We are a registered practitioner organization that's approved by the accreditation body. So just like Truth in Lending, just want to make sure everybody that's listening to this is clear that I've never been on the accreditation body. But to your question, there's actually been significant activity since the November 4th notification of CMMC 2.0. Soundway even had our own internal DIBCAC assessment paused, and we were mid-audit. So I continue to read and hear speculation as to what CMMC 2.0 means for the U.S. government contracting community, as well as for the Department of Defense and ultimately the entire United States government. In my opinion, the majority of what is being asserted as speculation is incorrect and comes from stakeholders that either, one, do not have detailed experience performing accreditation of U.S. federal or military systems, or two, are individuals that continue to, and I'm going to steal a millennial term like for my daughter, throwing shade on any level of third-party accountability. So why don't we start with what we know? First off, there used to be 5 maturity levels, and now that there are only 3. The assessment activity as described to date for level 1 still includes the original 17 controls that were defined, and level 2 now goes beyond the 110 controls as defined by NIST Special Publication 800-171 titled Protecting Control and Classified Information in Non-Federal Systems and Organizations. That's the Achilles heel in all of this, is that last word, organizations. In my experience, many companies that are wanting to do business fail to understand that this guidance document was intended for not only ensuring that the products that you're selling to the U.S. government are adequate in terms of cyber defense, but are also the company that's doing the selling is also equally prepared as well. There was a recent scoping document that intimates that if a government contractor has an outsourced security operations center, security incident advanced management tools, or something similar, that these capabilities are now in scope for the assessment. This is rapidly becoming a point of contention because the document does not provide context, unfortunately. Very reputable stakeholders in the CMMC ecosystem have argued whether or not it applies based on these third parties actually touching CUI within the hosting organization.
Okay, well, wait. I'm going to clarify for our listeners because we also sure. have a privacy audience. So this is great stuff, and it's so good, I want them to understand it. Before you get into any more detail, I want to back up on the levels 1, 2, and 3. So there were sure. 3 levels of maturity, and you had level 1 was for companies that maybe
maintain, store, or transmit what's called FCI, Federal Contract Information.
Right. But only with 17 controls. I mean, ISO has 114. So only with 17 controls, those would be companies that are maybe small businesses or aren't doing something terribly critical to the mission. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Then level 2 comes up to 110 practices that are aligned with now 800-171, right?
Yeah, they come actually directly from 800-171.
Yeah. And before, in the previous 5 levels, that was a blend, as I understood it, of a few different standards that were pulled together. And so now one of the changes is you went back to 800-171. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. Then when we go to level 3, that is 110. Those are experts. So that's 110 controls based on 800-172. Plus, and what the plus is for what? Mission critical, or what is the plus for?
Sure. So for level 3, you have the original 110 controls that are derived from 800-171. Mm-hmm. And then you have what is also known as 800-172, which think of it as kind of an additional bolt-on to 171. Whatever the security requirements are as described in 800-171, 800-172 takes it a little bit more granular, a little bit more definitive in terms of what you need to do. And so that's why they call them enhanced controls. So as an example, and I'm oversimplifying here, if 800-171 says you must have a firewall, then 800-172 says not only do you need to have a firewall, but you need to be able to do A, B, and C, and D within that firewall. So there's additional language that an assessor will evaluate the government contractor against.
Okay. Is 172 developed?
It is fully developed, yes.
Okay. All right. So thanks for that. I think that's very helpful. And whereas the previous model 1.0 did not allow any self-assessments, now we're back in 2.0 to allowing some. Is that right?
That is also correct.
Okay. Now, I interrupted you and I don't remember what you were saying right at that moment, but I think this is helpful so everybody has a sense of what we're talking about here. And these are government contractors that work for DOD. Does it apply to the intelligence community?
So, great question. If the intelligence community is operating under the umbrella of Department of Defense, then the answer is yes. You do have some intelligence components within the intelligence community itself under Justice Department, Homeland Security, where they are not subject to it at this time.
Okay. What about VA? Veterans Administration.
Veterans Administration is definitely within the scope of these requirements.
Okay. So part of NSA maybe?
To be determined, but it, by all accounts from the information that has been provided to date, it does not appear that anybody, any one department or agency under the DoD umbrella and its immediate counterparts, including NSA, will have a pass on this.
Will have a pass? What do you mean?
Meaning that everybody will have to operate off of the same sheet of music. It's not like NSA is going to get to say, well, we're not going to do that now. You guys do it, but we're not going to do it. Everybody's going to be operating off of the same program.
I see. Okay. So thanks very much for that background. Now, do you remember where I interrupted you?
Sure. So we were talking about the outsourcing of services such as a SOC or a SIM or things along those lines.
Right. So SOC is Security Operations Center.
Correct. So whether some like the bigger names that are out there are things like CrowdStrike, SecureWorks, things along those lines. And again, you know, I've seen very reputable stakeholders in the CMMC ecosystem that have argued that even if you have them, unless they are actually able to see you or touch a CUI, controlled and classified information data set, then it's not in scope. And I would actually argue that that's not what the right question is that people should be asking. The right question, in my opinion, that you should be asking is, does a third-party service or technology have administrative privileges?
Yeah.
And if so, I'm very much of the opinion that they are going to be defined in scope. It's important to remember, Jody, that not that long ago, about 9 MSPs, managed service providers, were compromised that negatively impacted all of their clients' security posture.
Oh, so, I get it.
So it's logical to conclude that the government would want to take a position to reduce or, you know, dramatically limit a similar transaction in the future for its supply chain.
Oh, I get it. And I agree. I agree completely. That is a huge question. And those companies may decide they don't want to be in that position.
It's very possible. It's definitely very possible. But again, following up from your original question, you know, companies that were originally targeting in conformance with CMMC level one, those companies that currently do not, nor they anticipate having control and classify information, will still have to conform with those original 17 controls. But as you said, now they do not need to be independently validated. And obviously that there was going to be a cost associated with those independent certifications. But what they have actually kind of, you know, be careful what you ask for. There was a lot of pressure brought on by lobbyists that represent the acquisition community, the small business councils and things like that. And the majority of reason in terms of why this took place appears to be to streamline and reduce costs on behalf of the small businesses, because the government realizes how dependent they are on small businesses. But yeah. Now with the self-attestation, what used to be a model of 3-3-1, meaning that in the old version, you would have to recertify every 3 years at level one, every 3 years at level three, and annually at level five, has kind of gone in reverse order. So now, if you're at level one, the same company CEO or president are now going to be required to sign a document that is legally binding, by the way, on an annual basis that the company in question is conforming with all 17 of the security controls from 800-171. And prior to CMMC 2.0 being formally announced about 3 weeks ago, it's also important for your listeners to understand that the Deputy U.S. Attorney General advised that there's going to be a new division funded to specifically address false claims acts associated with misrepresenting one's cyber risk posture. This could be a coincidence, but it's possible it's not. It's very possible that Justice Department is behind the scenes working in concert with the Department of Defense.
Well, I find this sort of refreshing. You know, I think when 800-171 was one of NIST's better efforts, and the contracting, a lot of the government contracting community was pretty happy with it. It did have the self-assessments, and there was a lot of discontentment about the CMMC Model 1.0. And I find it kind of refreshing someone in DOD had the guts to stand up and say, we're going to turn this train around. And I think companies really, I mean, in the private sector, like the financial industry, which Jerry is so steeped in, those CEOs, if you're in New York or within mm-hmm. the New York Department of Financial Services, you have to sign an annual statement by the chair or the CEO of the company mm-hmm. and send it into the New York Department of Financial Services every year with the same kind of thing. So what's wrong with holding companies? If you sign, they sign statements when they put in a proposal that everything in there is accurate and it's subject to the False Statements Act. So why is that such a big issue here?
I think it's the biggest issue is basically what everybody had originally presumed is now falling flat on its face. And what I mean by that is that basically you had companies that would take the position of saying, yeah, it's just another government requirement. They're never going to enforce it. So whatever, I will go ahead and I'll sign and I'll attest to it. And unfortunately, that easement that they had created never went checked. And as a result of this perfect storm that was being built by the government contractor saying, whatever, I'll sign it. You're never going to check on it anyway. Let me just win the business, was equally met by the government acquisition workforce never policing it until it was too late, until there was a sizable, significant issue that arose that dramatically impacted national security that kind of like rang the bell to say, what was the root cause analysis? Oh, it was this contractor. But wait, you said you signed off on this, but you actually weren't doing that? So I think now it's not, I mean, these are not actually new rules. I mean, these rules have been in effect since December of 2017. And with regards to the former head of this charge, you know, Ms. Katie Arrington, lover or hater, one of the things that, you know, she stipulated and was spot on, in my opinion, and also made me laugh is, you know, help me understand, everybody's up in arms about these new costs. You guys have been in testing that you've been doing this for years. So what are these additional quote unquote costs that you're referring to? So I think it's really a matter now of pens down, tests are done. And instead of everybody kind of like checking each other's work and everybody's going to be the friend and give you everybody 100, you now actually have the teacher collecting the exams and going, what are you kidding me?
Yeah. This has been a great introduction to this soup. And so now that we've gotten it all stirred up and hot, I want to throw it over to Jerry. Jerry?
Thanks a lot, Jody. Well, Carter, by the way, it really is a privilege to have you with us today. And I'm learning along with our audience some of the details of areas that you and Jody know far better than I. This has been such an important and confusing topic for many American companies. And your history and knowledge of the program is really valuable to our listeners. We hear a lot about the cost of CMMC, and you were just referencing some of that. The cost of government contractors complying, the cost of assessments, the amount of the government will allow for those in its contracts. What are some of the expensive ticket items for a company that's trying to conform with CMMC 2.0? And has 2.0 changed the cost from 1.0?
So, Jerry, the costs have been a huge point of contention. So I'll try to address your questions point by point. And I, too, hear all the time, you know, it's too expensive. Well, my response is, well, compared to what, though? You know, a few chapters ago in my life, you know, I actively participated in MITRE's quarterly supply chain risk forum, which predominantly focused on counterfeit chipsets or aircraft parts. But at these sessions, I would hear small business owners jump on this bandwagon and, you know, it's of it being too expensive and too burdensome. And then during breakout sessions, being privy to water cooler discussions with govies saying, it's too expensive. How about you do it to justify keeping the ability to do business with us? So the fact that there's been a statutory obligation of safeguard that neither the contractors nor the government ever enforced, you know, unfortunately, this is one of these issues that I just made reference to where, you know, now that somebody's actually examining what you're testing to, people are kind of like scurrying around trying to figure out like, so what are some of the costs? So to your point on how has 2.0 changed the cost of ownership from 1.0? The answer is roughly between $3,000 to $5,000. That's it. Basically, whatever the original cost was going to be, to be assessed at that level by a certified third-party assessing organization. In the past year of assessment, Soundway is done, plus the dozen or so that I have firsthand experience with another firm. The biggest ticket items may not be what you think that they are. You know, people presume that because it's cyber, it's a pure play IT issue. This is categorically false. Unless business owners start looking at cyber as a business risk, not any different than fire, theft, or flood, they are likely going to be doomed to repeat the same mistakes that everybody else has made that has made the cover of the Wall Street Journal or a CNN or a Fox headline. So some of the largest costs of ownership is not the actual buying of tech, but the internal burn costs for levels of effort to adopt these 110 controls. And as for the tech side, here's what I can share with you to date. One, multi-factor authentication, which can range actually from zero cost if you're using Microsoft to about $10 a month per person for other capabilities like Duo, CyberArk, or et cetera. Number two, you know, maintaining an approved cloud-based solution like Prevail or Microsoft's government cloud computing in the higher environment, this is actually going to be dependent on how many people need to have access to the actual controlled unclassified information or otherwise being defined as regulated data. And it's a good ballpark to basically budget about $1,600 a year per person. But remember, if you're a company and you're only targeting being at level one, the majority of these technical controls may not apply. Number three, the ability to review system logs. My recommendation is to outsource this because small to medium-sized businesses rarely have a dedicated cyber resource. And having done log reviews in the past, it's very tedious. It's extremely time-consuming and also has a high rate of failure for missing potential indicators of compromise, which is a nice segue for my next point. Number four, separation of duties. The cost to attract and retain a qualified cyber person is very high. And keeping in mind, separation of duties is actually a specific call out, whether it's CMMC or 800-171. And this is why SoundWay created a service offering that addresses this and seven other controls within a subscription model that's very cost effective. Number five, incident response plans. This is unfortunately very generally confused with a disaster recovery plan, if a plan even exists. Creating one that is actionable and repeatable takes experienced practitioners and can cost anywhere from $2,000 to $10,000. And lastly, having a unified capability to address BYOD environments, bring your own device environments. This can actually be done via Microsoft and other solution providers, and the costs range from a flat fee to a monthly recurring fee. Does that answer your question, Jerry?
It does, but let me understand this. When you say $3,000 to $5,000, it's $3,000 to $5,000 per user or employee, or is it overall $3,000 to $5,000?
In terms of the difference in savings for 2.0 to 1.0, that is actually per company. So that $3,000 to $5,000 figure is what the government estimated it would cost a government contractor to be independently certified at level one.
But that's the cost of getting the certification, but not necessarily the cost of building the system that is...
That is absolutely correct. And that is unfortunately where there's been a lot of disconnect because historically people have heard these dollar values that were being promoted by the Department of Defense that, quite frankly, were very askewed from reality. Now, whether it was unintentional or whether it was by design, these numbers that were being socialized were always attributed to the cost of that third party coming in and being and certifying the company. And then in turn, having a rubric model that even as defined within the interim rule for the FAR and the DFAR, that you could then say, all right, for a level one or a level three or a level five, based on the old paradigm, the government would then be able to say, all right, your normal cost of ownership for this proposal, again, I'm oversimplifying here, is $100,000. Well, it's a level one. So now it's $105,000. So yeah, you could actually have that level of cost capture on the back end. But to your point, it never addressed the buildup costs.
To your earlier point, some would say, well, you were supposed to be doing a lot of this anyway, weren't you? So that seems to be the buildup cost is building up to where you should have been. Is that accurate, Carter?
That is accurate. However, there are some nuances to taking that position. And the nuances would also include the presumption that every company that is pursuing business with the U.S. government has been in play since December of 2017. So if you are just set up shop within, let's say, the past year, I would probably make the argument that they should be entitled for the buildup costs because it's a contractual obligation.
Yeah. And how does the government calculate how they'll reimburse you for that additional cost for serving them?
So with 2.0, that will be to be determined. But I think that the original levels of effort, they actually, again, they had this in the interim rule, and the interim rule within the Federal Defense Acquisition Regulation Supplement had clearly defined estimated levels of effort by man hours, the associated cost for each man hour, which I will advise was categorically incorrect. These labor rates were incredibly low. They were not market commensurate. And as a result, creates a false sense of what the government should have anticipated or should currently anticipate would be a cost for an organization seeking certification.
There is this very interesting, you know, circle. The government's paying for it ultimately anyway. So it makes it enacts or puts out MC1 or 2.0. And of course, that's going to add to the cost of being a government contractor. And that means it's going to get passed through in large part to the government.
Companies today have to have an enterprise cybersecurity program. We've known that for years. Companies haven't wanted to do it, so they've gotten by with the bare minimums. So now when you're in the financial industry, or you're a government contractor, and people are saying, you really do, if you want to do business with us, have to have an enterprise security program. And here are the controls. Now, in the financial sector, they say, go pick a best practice. Pick NIST, go pick ISO, pick COBIT, pick one of these that is internationally recognized as a leading cybersecurity standard, peg to that, and then tell us how mature you are. And I don't see that any different for the government, because there are lots of companies who are both public and private sector. And as long as they have an enterprise security program pegged to a best practice, then, and they're building their maturity on that, you know, I don't think the government necessarily needs to say it needs to be our number one or two. But at the same time, we've mapped all these standards to each other. So, okay, fine. If we're following another, we'll just map it over to 800-171-172, and then we'll see how we're doing. So I don't see this as a big cost for companies. To your point, if they were doing it as what they were supposed to be doing all along. But that's the point, is the government contractors haven't done it all along, especially defense contractors. The civilian contractors have had to do this all along and comply with FISMA, and no one has ever put it in the cost of a contract. It's not something civilian agencies have paid government contractors for, is to meet cybersecurity compliance requirements. So why do we pay DOD contractors to do that? I mean, that's a fair question. So, Carter,
I'll turn that over to Carter for an answer. Go ahead.
Yeah, so being familiar with the kinds of contracts that have come out from everything from U.S. Census to Homeland Security to Justice Department, some of them will have language that says, you know, depending on what you're doing, such as if you're hosting a system for them, then that system must be in conformance with FISMA. That's absolutely correct. But it's also important to note that Homeland Security also has its own regulations. It's called the Homeland Security Acquisition Regulations. And right now, the Department of Homeland Security is currently even doing their own pilot for CMMC. So, at least in my opinion, it's going to be a problem if you have multiple departments and agencies under the umbrella of the U.S. government potentially asking a government contractor for the same thing, but asking for it in three different ways.
Well, I don't think they should, but if they start going back to every agency having their own regs, we're going to have a fragmented mess, and we'll end up with companies that only do business with the federal government. And you're not going to get then the best from the private sector. I think this is all a big problem, but FISMA is a federal law, and it's been out there since like 2002 or something like that. So,
but that only applies to federal information systems.
Well, it applied. It did not. It excluded national security systems, and that is all. But General Meyer Rose and then John Grimes got together, and they worked with NIST, and it was the Joint Task Force, and they made then the NIST guidance applicable across the defense, intel, and full civilian agencies. It was government-wide.
Correct. But when I say federal, I mean U.S. government. It did not inherently apply to a government contractor.
Well, FISMA applies as a federal law to every government contractor. It just didn't apply to national security systems.
Actually, I would say that that's not incorrect in terms of my interpretation of that. the Federal Information Security Modernization Act, which is predicated upon NIST 853, now Revision 5. Again, it's designed for federal information systems and organizations. That's what NIST 853 was originally predicated upon. So again, federal information systems and organizations. Now, you may have had people representing the government throwing out narratives in solicitations, in many cases, probably inappropriately. But just as you have certain clauses that are applicable only to federal agencies that are kind of being conflated, so to speak, with other contractual obligations, you could actually argue that these terms and conditions were put in inappropriately for the government contracting community. But again, that's depending on the circumstances and it's a case-by-case basis. If I am a company and I want a contract and part of that support is for me to provide, let's say, an enclave within Amazon, then yes, absolutely. The part that I bought, owned, and control that is directly supporting that mission, that project, that is in scope. But my corporate enterprise absolutely was not bound by FISMA.
Okay, well, I think in some areas it was, but that's not for us to argue about here. I want to give this back to Jerry because I know he wanted to ask about what trouble lies ahead. So, Jerry, I'm giving this back to you.
All right. Carter, do you envision their creation of a CMMC 3.0? And if so, what do you think would happen? And what would it look like? And when would you expect it to occur, if at all?
So there's actually information that supports that NIST is already revising 800-171. So it's logical to conclude not only will CMMC 3.0 be inevitable, but so will 4.0, 5.0, and so on. But this is a good thing, or at least it has the potential to be. The standard was always conveyed, even back in the days of Katie Arrington, that this is going to be dynamic and designed to align with the current cyber threat landscape. In a podcast that I did a few months ago, I was actually asked a similar question before 2.0 was announced. And my comments were, depending on what the cyber threat landscape is, that 130 controls maybe goes to 119, maybe goes to 142. That all depends on what the cyber threat landscape holds for us all. That is actually, I would say, probably the biggest challenge and the biggest misstep in this entire paradigm. Nobody ever has evaluated what were the common factors that have caused some of the biggest breaches to U.S. government contractors. All they know is it's happening. Whereas it may have been a more pragmatic approach to understand what are some of the controls within NIST 853 or another guidance document, create a subset of that because it's based upon data, not just we know something's happening and we know we have to make a knee-jerk response and we need to have something that's actionable really quick. Without being able to focus on the data in terms of why these things are happening, this whole notion of, well, here's our baseline and we're going to continue to revise it, hopefully that gives them enough cycle time to be able to hone what 3.0 or 4.0 or 5.0 is going to be. My personal belief is that what 3.0 will look like is, right now, NIST 800-171 in its current version has a total of 110 controls for safeguarding. And then much further down in the document, there's an appendix section that describes a whole battery of additional controls that, in my opinion, are not going to be looked at, but they are presumed all companies do them in the first place, which is a grossly incorrect assumption. But what I do envision there's a possibility for happening is with NIST 853, Revision 4, they had at one point, I think it was in Appendix J, a battery of privacy controls. These privacy controls, if you look at them, are actually very similar to the types of questions that are going to be asked if you have to conform with GDPR or the California Consumer Privacy Act and so on. But in the latest iteration, Revision 5, those controls that were taken from the appendix section have now been moved into the body of the base controls. I believe when 3.0 comes out, that's what we're going to see. These additional controls in the appendix being revised and captured into the core base controls. So hopefully that answers your question.
It does. Very interesting. Yeah. The other observation that I think I heard you making is that there really hasn't been a learning from the incidents there has to be more connectivity between the new versions and the problems that have emerged in the real world. Is that fair, Carter? Is that what I was hearing?
I agree 100%. Now, historically, Americans, I'm going to truth in lending. I love my country. I don't want any harm to come in my country. But historically, we got a pretty high bravado and we generally take the position of it's never going to happen to us. And unfortunately, we are also a 2-week memory nation. So out of sight, out of mind, and we generally fail to learn from our past mistakes. I believe.
Sadly, that's why we have more deaths from COVID than any other country. Our freedom is a wonderful thing, and I'm very much in favor of it, but it does leave us with the opportunity to, as you say, have bravado that may be unjustified.
Well, but to follow up on that, Jerry, the other thing is that there's some theories about, you know, you were asking, what's the next standard going to look like? You know, what's the next version going to look like? Well, there's some counterparties to that too. You actually have some people that have a theory that think the CMMC might die off with whomever takes over 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue next. But my belief is that this will be countered with a small to a medium-sized military engagement with China over the next year or so that will be cyber-led and have significant consequences to our military on land, air, and sea. And after the dust settles, you can bet the root cause analysis will show that issues stemming from our supply chain led to China's successful attack on our military. Then the government will more likely than not rattle a saber once again, and we may go back to something like CMMC 1.0, where it becomes even more scrutinous.
Well, that is probably the most significant element of our discussion today, and the most quotable anyway. Very interesting.
So it is, but it bothers me because the government has always, its government contracting process is screwed up in part because it is so overly prescriptive, especially at DOD. This is why everything's so expensive out there, is because they want to tell every little feature that has to be figured and worked and built into a contract. And the threat environment is so complex. The system architectures are so complex that, yes, there can be common things of what happened. But thinking we're going to respond to everything with more and more requirements and more regulations, to me, that is not the right direction. The more you try to ratchet everything down, then the fewer people you'll have bidding. And it's, to me, is very problematic. But I want it out of this mess, Carter. What are your thoughts that you think the White House and Congress can learn from this? Everyone's clamoring about cybersecurity. CISA and the White House are issuing guidance and executive orders. It seems that everyone could use some policy guidance here to think about instead of knee-jerk responses to events. What would be your advice to Congress in considering cybersecurity and to the White House for that matter?
So Jody, you know, the White House is interesting, especially because Biden's cybersecurity executive order that came out a few months ago, because now government contractors have a legal obligation to notify Homeland Security when a breach occurs. I think this is a step in the right direction, but we also have to be careful what we ask for. Because first off, what even constitutes a breach? I mean, that generally means sensitive information of some semblance went out the door. Having a successful cyber incident defined as placing a remote piece of malicious code that goes undetected for remote command and control, in my opinion, I mean, that's far more broad and could lead to the Chinese scenario that I just highlighted. But if no data is forensically seen as going out the door, that would not meet the trigger, so to speak. So I actually enjoyed the session recently, well, fairly recently, between Senator Manchin and Jesse Salazar with the Department of Defense. The look on the senator's face did not convey to me he really had any confidence in what government contractors are doing to protect national secrets. So my advice to Congress is this. One, start looking inward instead of outward. The acquisition workforce that acts on behalf of the DoD is in desperate need of education, informal training, beyond video instruction previously being provided by the Defense Acquisition University. And number two, make sure that DHS and DoD are in alignment with one unified CMMC model, regardless of what DHS does as a result of their own internal CMMC pilot program. There exists an inability for a civilian agency to have access to the military systems that will house the CMMC certification data. And my advice to the White House, whomever holds the mantle as the head of the executive branch, please spend some money to launch awareness campaigns beyond the DC Beltway. Do a traveling roadshow if necessary. I mean, areas like the Midwest and et cetera are demonstrating that they have little or no clue about these requirements. And secondly, focus on programs that teach economically disadvantaged high school students core competencies in cyber. That would be my recommendations to Congress and to the White House.
You know, Carter, that is an extraordinarily valuable set of observations. And, you know, at the very end, you mentioned the idea of reaching out to disadvantaged young people and training them. I happen to be involved with a charity where one of our board members is doing exactly that in San Antonio with a pretty significant contract from Microsoft. And it's very promising. So I think that really is a great thing. There's going to be an enormous amount of career opportunity in this space. And Jody has been very active in developing programs that help people develop the skills to operate at a fairly high level. But still, there is so much needed, obviously. I just want to say this has been a very educational session for me, and your observations about the potential for an incident that is not kinetic warfare, but cyber conflict with China is a fascinating observation.
So Jerry, I wanted to just kind of like pull on that thread a little bit. So I think it might be helpful for your audience to understand. So what does Carter really mean by that? So if we have a fleet of ships in the Sea of Japan that are moving in the direction towards one of the islands that China had built that's in a disputed territory, I'm not suggesting that all of a sudden computers at the Pentagon are being compromised. What I am suggesting is that there could be a scenario, how likely to be determined, but I could envision a scenario where we have a fleet of ships going in a certain direction, and then all of a sudden some of them, the entire power source gets shut down. And then immediately thereafter, receiving a communique from the Chinese authorities warning, are you sure you want to go down this path with us?
Oh, really frightening, frankly, particularly in light of the tensions in
absolutely. Yep.
Straits of Formosa. Well, this has been a very interesting session. And Jody, I'm tempted to let you finish, but let me just myself say thank you so much, Carter, for sharing both your deep knowledge of the technical side of these things and your policy insights. It's been very, very helpful. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
It really has. I mean, we haven't had a discussion with this in depth and this level of expertise. And so thank you so much, Carter, because you've been in it and you know it, and it's really been a rich discussion. Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining us this week on the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy the show and want more content on the issues we cover, you can visit adcg.org. The Association for Data and Cyber Governance is the leading association connecting all aspects of data management, cybersecurity, and governance. Our listeners can use code POD at checkout for 50% off membership. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.